Ahmed Enti with your worldwide news update. Israel's defense minister has ordered the Israel Defense Forces to devise a plan for Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip, following U.S. President Donald Trump's proposal for how the territory would be administered. Katz welcomed what he characterized as Trump's quote-unquote bold plan for Gaza residents to leave the territory, which has been devastated by Israeli ground and air attacks targeting Hamas militants. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu celebrated Trump's proposal in a video message from Washington, D.C. As you know, the day before yesterday, I had a historic meeting with President Trump, which was a great turning point for the future of Israel. At this meeting, he also brought up his idea about Gaza for the day after Hamas, and I think it is worth listening very well to this idea, which is the first original idea to be raised in years. Meanwhile, U.S. designated terror group Hamas on Thursday called on all Palestinian factions to unite against Trump's proposed Gaza takeover. The plan has been criticized by U.S. allies and adversaries alike, many of which remain committed to creation of an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Friday that talks with the United States would be, quote, not rational, wise, or honorable, unquote. AP correspondent Karen Chemas has more.
Iran's Supreme Leader has said that negotiations with America are not intelligent, wise, or honorable after President Donald Trump floated nuclear talks with Tehran. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei also suggested that there should be no negotiations with such a government, but stopped short of issuing a direct order not to engage with Washington. Khamenei's remarks to Air Force officers in Tehran on Friday appeared to contradict his own earlier remarks that opened the door to talks. The 85-year-old Khamenei always has carefully threaded his remarks about negotiating with the West. I'm Karen Chamas.
This is VOA News. Authorities are searching along part of Alaska's western coast for a plane that went missing while carrying 10 people. The Bering Air Caravan was flying a route over the Norton Sound south of the Arctic Circle. It went missing before 4 p.m. Thursday, and the authorities are working to determine the plane's last known coordinates. The local fire department issued an update early Friday that said the crews were still searching on the ground and that there was no new information on the location of the plane. Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba is set to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump at the White House on Friday. Japanese officials say they want to reaffirm the U.S.-Japan alliance and build strong personal ties between Ishiba and Trump. VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
Some in Japan question why Ishiba is meeting Trump right now at all. Instead, they ask, why not stay off Trump's radar as long as possible? Others argue it's better to be proactive, in part to protect against any future strains in the alliance. Miyako Nakabayashi is a former Japanese lawmaker.
Some people say that don't wake up sleeping baby, but you have to take a risk if you want to have a better relationship.
It's the same dynamic facing virtually every U.S. ally as Trump again pursues his America First approach to the world. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
The United Nations warned Friday that the worst may be yet to come if the violence engulfing the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo spreads throughout the wider region. The DRC requested an urgent meeting of the UN's top rights body to discuss the escalating fighting by Rwanda-backed armed group, the M23, in North and South Kivu provinces. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk. The risk of escalation of violence throughout the sub-region has never been higher. All those who exert influence over the parties involved, whether countries or non-state actors, must redouble their efforts to avoid a conflagration and support peace processes. Turk was addressing a special session of the UN Human Rights Council, which will decide on Friday whether to launch an international investigation into alleged violations and abuses committed amid the deadly clashes. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis visited Santorini Island on Friday, saying the state is monitoring the increased seismic activity and urging the public to remain calm.
Santorini is no stranger to active geological phenomena. This is exactly what we are currently observing. Lots of medium-sized earthquakes that don't at present pose any real risk or any real danger to the island.
Greece declared a state of emergency on Santorini on Thursday as hundreds of earthquakes have rattled the popular tourist island over the past week. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's high time for Africans and other people to depend on themselves and not depend from the Western aid, because this is what can be the drawbacks.
That was Mamadou Tiore, a journalist and chair of a media watchdog, on how the suspension of U.S. foreign aid is forcing African countries to become more self-sufficient. Details coming up also. Aid groups say sexual violence is a constant threat for women inside Sudan's embattled Darfur region. And more than 150 female prisoners were burned to death during a jailbreak in Goma last week. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Today, the UN Human Rights Office said it has received reports of cases of sexual violence involving the DRC's army and its allied forces. More than 150 female prisoners were raped and burned to death during a jailbreak last week. Regarding the incident, reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti tells me until proper investigation is completed, it is hard to pinpoint the blame on any certain group. He starts out by describing the general mood in Goma today.
So now the life is in Goma, in the city center of Goma, is normal except some northern neighborhoods where some bandit activities are being done. But in the downtown city center, everything, the mood had reached is 100%. Bars are opening, restaurants are working, people are dancing, music everywhere. And for now, we can say life has become normal in Goma.
And talk to us about, you attended the stadium meeting yesterday with M23 leadership, and they were actually recruiting people.
M23, at their first popular meeting, got around 7,000 people listening to them in the stadium and outside the stadium, the limite of Goma. And when the coordinator of AFC, Mr. Colonel Nanga, called to young people to join them in order to create a NAMI to continue fighting till Kinshasa, many young people joined them.
And Jafar, the big news today is the UN Human Rights Office has said that there are reports of cases of sexual violence involving the DRC's army. And this is in regards to last week, where more than 150 female prisoners were raped and burned to death during a jailbreak. More than 4,000 detainees fled the Muzinzi prison that day.
Yeah, and it's not only the problem of this war, it's the fact that we didn't know who is who. When losing the control of the city, soldiers were looting the civilian of Goma. What happened in Muzinzi is horrible, because hundreds of women were victims of rape and many people dead. And we still don't know who killed them, because what happened in the Muzinzi prison, we can't say that it's FRDC who killed, or Wazalendo, or M23. Maybe if soon some investigation can be done.
And Jafar, DRC Communications Minister Patrick Muyaya has confirmed the rape of the women, and he actually saying the government condemns with the greatest energy this barbaric crime. But you are saying it's very hard to tell who did what.
Exactly. The government has the rights of accusation. I'm a journalist. I can't accuse anyone. M23 has also the right of accusation. So M23 is accusing the government, or the FRDC. The government is accusing M23.
Anything else you'd like to add today, Jafar?
Today was the inauguration of the new M23 administration in the city of Goma and the province of North Kivu. The governor of North Kivu and his two deputies was inaugurated today by Corneille Nangaa and Bertrand Bisimwa. The governor, who is a military officer of M23, Bahati Joseph, said he came to work for people and to develop the province of North Kivu. Also, close to him, the mayor of Goma was inaugurated. So for now, M23 has the administration of the province of North Kivu because they now have the majority, the biggest part of North Kivu.
Reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti talking to me from Goma. At a special session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, UN experts condemned Rwanda's alleged support of M23 rebels and called for the Rwanda Defense Forces and their M23 allies to withdraw from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
In kicking off the emergency session Friday, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, told the Human Rights Council he's been worried about the human rights situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo for many years. He said the M23 armed group has intensified its offensive in North and South Kivu provinces since the beginning of the year. Türk said the M23 is supported by the Rwanda Defense Forces, which the Rwandan government has never confirmed. He said nearly 3,000 people have been killed and 2,880 injured since January 26, when M23 rebels captured the city of Goma, adding the real figures are likely much higher. He spoke through an interpreter.
And tensions are currently rising in South Kivu. If nothing's done, then the worst could still be yet to come for the inhabitants of the eastern part of the country, but also in people living beyond the DRC's borders.
The DRC Minister of Communications and Media, Patrick Muyaya Katembwe, lashed out at the violations against civilians allegedly committed by the M23, which is part of an alliance known as AFC. He also accused Rwanda forces of being involved. He said indiscriminate bombing against camps for internally displaced people and populated areas have compounded a catastrophic situation. He accused the rebels of deliberately targeting vulnerable people. He spoke through an interpreter.
In view of this situation, the Democratic Republic of Congo calls for the establishment of an international commission of inquiry to examine human rights violations committed in my country. This commission must have a mandate to establish the truth as to who is responsible for these crimes and to provide recommendations for holding them accountable.
Rwanda's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, James Ngango, accused the council of a double standard, noting that no special session had been called to examine the 1994 genocidal war against ethnic Tutsis in Rwanda. He said he categorically opposed attempts to portray Rwanda as being responsible for the insecurity in eastern DRC and said its own territory is at risk.
What is clear, however, is the imminent threat the current situation poses to Rwanda. Following the fall of Goma, new evidence has come in light regarding an imminent large-scale attack against Rwanda. The Kinshasa-backed coalition has stockpiled a large number of weapons and military equipment near Rwanda's border.
Rwanda has denied having troops fighting alongside the M23, but has said its forces have acted to protect its border territory and its citizens. Rwanda also has long accused the DRC of backing the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, or FDLR. This group is led by ethnic Hutu rebels who fled after Tutsi-led fighters captured Kigali in 1994 and ended the genocide against ethnic Tutsis. The Rights Council was not persuaded by this argument. The 47-member body called for the establishment of an independent fact-finding mission to investigate serious human rights violations and abuses committed in the provinces of North and South Kivu. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Aid groups say sexual violence is a constant threat for women inside Sudan's embattled region of Darfur, but refugees VOA spoke with also say it's a problem for those who have fled the region. Reporting from a refugee camp on Chad's border with Darfur, Henry Wilkins looks at the phenomenon of firewood rape.
On Chad's border with Darfur, refugees venture out into the scrub to collect firewood. The women say they sometimes travel several kilometres from the refugee camp looking for branches or tree roots to burn for cooking. But so-called firewood rape is an all too common occurrence here. This woman says she was out collecting wood when her group was approached by men carrying knives and axes.
We ran away. They caught one of us. I was injured near my waist but got away.
VOA has changed the names and concealed the identity of all the women interviewed in this report to protect them from reprisals. Sexual assault against women collecting firewood is a common phenomenon in refugee camps, according to researchers. For Amina, it seems there is no escape from the threat of sexual violence. Before she fled here, she witnessed other women sexually assaulted by members of the paramilitary rapid support forces who came to her home in Darfur.
They beat and harassed people. They raped and killed. I saw what happened to girls in front of me and old ladies.
Rights groups say they've recorded dozens of rapes of women by RSF-associated militias in Darfur. Fatimata says she and her daughters were victims of the RSF.
They raped me. They raped my daughter, and she died. We don't sleep at night because we are afraid that they will come and kill us. It's a nightmare that never ends.
For these women, whether in the scrub outside the camp or the homes they fled in Darfur, the shadow of sexual violence is ever present. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202-258-3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. African governments gear up for what is to come following the 90-day pause in U.S.-funded foreign aid as they worry about the potential effects. Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has this report.
In response to the recent decision by the United States to freeze and review U.S.-funded foreign aid worldwide with some exceptions, Kenyan Health Cabinet Secretary Deborah Barasa said Wednesday in Nairobi that as her country navigates complex challenges, ensuring continuation of essential health services, especially with programs related to HIV/AIDS and tuberculosis, is essential. While the orders have been modified to allow waivers for life-saving humanitarian assistance, including core life-saving medicine, which may apply to health programs such as PEPFAR, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which works with partners in 55 countries worldwide, many countries are working to assess the implications of what may amount to an end of U.S. foreign aid. One of them is South Africa. With 7.8 million people with HIV, it's been one of the biggest beneficiaries of the PEPFAR program the past two decades. Its health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, told reporters last week in Johannesburg that the country was taken by surprise by the recent decision and they are still trying to decipher the full meaning. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he has long supported foreign aid, but that it is also not a charity. He says the waiver is clear.
If it saves lives, if it's emergency life-saving aid, food, medicine, whatever, they have a waiver. I don't know how much clearer we can be.
This week, Motsoaledi met with U.S. embassy officials to discuss bilateral health cooperation and the new U.S. policies on assistance. The two sides promised to keep the communications channels open as they discuss life-saving health partnerships. Asanda Goesheng, a South African political analyst, said countries will be affected one way or the other.
Because a lot of public health systems, a lot of public health administration, a lot of public health infrastructure only exists because of the PEPFAR program. And even in cases where PEPFAR is not funding 100% of programs, any money that is removed means that countries simply won't be able to afford programs that they were able to afford with the money that was being supplemented by PEPFAR before.
Non-health-related programs are also being affected. In Senegal, for example, an infrastructure and development project financed by the Millennium Challenge Corporation, an initiative that was started by Republican President George W. Bush, could lose funding. The $550 million power project being implemented by Millennium Challenge Account Senegal was designed to improve the country's transmission network and increase electricity access in rural areas and those on the outskirts of cities in the south and central regions. Mamadou Chor, a journalist and chair of the media watchdog CORED, tells VOA Senegalese Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko recently addressed the issue.
Senegal has been experiencing the MCA in his second phase. It was dealing with electricity, mostly in rural areas. And the financing coming from the U.S. for this second phase will impact something like 12 million people. The day before yesterday, the prime minister launching a water project in rural areas was disappointed to announce people about this sad news.
Sonko emphasized the need for countries to work on being self-sufficient.
It's high time for Africans and other people to depend on themselves and not depend from the Western aid, because this is what can be the drawbacks. The new leaders of Senegal, they are focusing on national sovereignty. Ousmane Sonko, being the leader of sovereignty-defending politician, so they will have to depend on national resources to go ahead with the rest of the project, because there is no way to go backward.
Finally, in Nigeria, a country that received about $1 billion in U.S. foreign aid last year, officials this week launched a committee with members from finance, health, and environmental ministries to develop an alternative for some USAID-funded programs. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
President Donald Trump's point person for making rapid changes at U.S. governmental agencies is Elon Musk. The chief executive of carmaker Tesla and aerospace company SpaceX. Congressional Democrats say the Trump-backed multi-billionaire's attempt to reduce federal government spending is wrong. Michelle Quinn looks at what Musk has been doing in Washington.
A protest outside a federal agency in Washington this week focused on the work of Elon Musk, President Donald Trump's designee for shrinking the U.S. government. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy.
The people get to decide how we defend the United States of America. The people get to decide how their taxpayer money is spent. Elon Musk does not get to decide.
Musk is the world's richest man and the chief executive of electric vehicle firm Tesla and aerospace company SpaceX. He also owns other companies, including the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter. Since Trump's inauguration, Musk, as the leader of the newly created Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has gotten down to work cutting what he and President Trump see as costly federal programs. Musk's team has reportedly gained access to the Treasury Department's payment systems, raising alarms, and has sought control of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, which provides humanitarian and other aid to more than 100 countries. That's where the protests happened this week. Democratic Representative Don Beyer.
President Trump directed his corrupt billionaire friend, Elon Musk, to ransack a critical agency of the U.S. government.
Trump, however, reiterated his support for Musk.
It's something that he feels very strongly about, and I'm impressed because he's running, obviously, a big company.
Elon Musk said what he discovered at USAID isn't salvageable.
As we dug into USAID, it became apparent that what we have here is not an apple with a worm in it, but we have actually just a bowl of worms.
Congressional Democrats dispute that and say it is wrong that Musk has so much power and little accountability and oversight, especially given that SpaceX has contracts with the federal government. Democratic Senator Patty Murray.
An unelected, unaccountable billionaire with expansive conflicts of interest, deep ties to China, and an indiscreet axe to grind against perceived enemies is hijacking our nation's most sensitive financial data systems and its checkbook.
But Trump says that the White House is providing the necessary oversight to Musk's work.
Where we think there's a conflict or there's a problem, we won't let him go near it. But we're trying to shrink government, and he can probably shrink it as well as anybody else, if not better.
In his unpaid role as a special government employee, Musk is permitted to work no more than 130 days a year. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
And in our sports roundup, we have VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro in studio to brief us on the latest. Thank you for being on Africa News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thank you for having me, Hayes.
So in the world of football, the English Premier League is off this weekend, but La Liga has some big matches. Talk to us about that.
Absolutely, Hayes. If we're just going to go into this clash of the weekend in La Liga, it'll be Real Madrid versus Atletico Madrid. This is the number one and number two team, respectively. Real Madrid currently has a one-point lead over Atletico Madrid. They have 49 points. Atletico has 48. This is very tight, meaning if Atletico is able to win over Real Madrid this weekend, they overtake both of them. What a time that a league like La Liga not having Barcelona or Real Madrid at the top. You know, Atletico Madrid is a relatively known team, but it's not Real Madrid and it is not Barcelona.
And in the NBA, the trades that occurred last weekend are still being talked about. Have there been more developments as to why they happened?
Yes, we are still confused as to how the Dallas Mavericks let go of Luka Doncic for what they said is 40 cents on the dollar. They really look like, you know, the LA Lakers, for what it's worth, have come away. This almost feels like a highway robbery to be able to pull off a 25-year-old Luka Doncic who just is an MVP caliber player who just went to the NBA Finals to then trade him for Anthony Davis on his back leg of his career at 31 years old with injury prone is difficult. But we also seen another huge trade that happened. Jimmy Butler leaves the Miami Heat and goes to the Golden State Warriors. That is a huge move for him. And lastly, De'Aaron Fox, who was supposed to be the Sacramento Kings franchise point guard, goes to San Antonio Spurs and joins Wembanyama, the 7'4" young man. So now you have a young core. Those two can do some real damage as well.
They could. The Super Bowl is happening this weekend, Mokbil. The Philadelphia Eagles versus the Kansas City Chiefs. Who do you think will win?
Oh, if Kansas wants to have it their way, they would have the three-peat. That'll be three years in a row. Now, the Philadelphia Eagles really have looked like the strongest team in the NFL this year, not only with their quarterback Jalen Hurts, but having the best running back in the league, Saquon Barkley, who was released by the New York Giants for literally nothing. So he is on a vengeance tour, and we're going to see what he's able to do. But it's going to be action-packed Sunday. We're watching.
Super Bowl, very exciting in the U.S. VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Keila Williams, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.